How's everybody's lunch? Delicious? At this time, we'd like to invite to the podium Chip Perry, who is the CEO and president of Autotrader.com, as well as Troy Clark, who is the president of General Motors North America. Welcome to the podium, and I guess let's let the games begin.
Thank you, Adam. It's a thrill to be here today in the Atlanta community. We're based here in Atlanta, Autotrader.com, and it's a great honor to have a chance to introduce Troy Clark, the president of General Motors North America. At Autotrader.com, we specialize in bringing automotive buyers and sellers together on the internet. The web has really become a very mainstream way for people to shop, and it's becoming more and more of a mainstream way for auto manufacturers and dealers to do business. And at General Motors, as an innovative company, they're more and more addressing the internet and embracing the internet as one of their key marketing tools. But at General Motors, they really are the key originator of the automotive industry in America. They literally invented the modern industrial corporation in the 1920s. A gentleman named Alfred P. Sloan really came up with a whole idea of how a corporation should be run. And today, after living through many different changes in gas prices, environmental challenges and concerns, consumer tastes changing, import competition, General Motors is in the process of reinventing itself. It remains the number one car company in the world, with well more than 9 million vehicles a year sold into the marketplace, with venerable brands that we all know and grew up with. I was telling Troy that my family was an Oldsmobile family growing up. My granddad always had a Delta 88 in the driveway, a convertible, with the holes on the side. And actually, that was Buick. But and then my first car when I was growing up in our family, I had to learn how to parallel park a 1964 Delta 88 station wagon, one of those big long ones. And so there's a lot of folks out there who grew up with General Motors products, and I believe more and more are going to be going back to them. Troy has been a leader at General Motors for a long time. He joined the company in 1973. He's a Michigander, graduate of General Motors Institute, and I'm going to say this because there's a few other alums in the room, the University of Michigan. How about it? You got some right here. And he's worked his way up through the company. You know, a classic story of a gentleman whose family came from the manufacturing side of the automotive industry. Worked his way up through manufacturing, been in charge of labor relations, and now runs all of North America. So he has a huge job. And it's a delight and a real privilege to have a chance to introduce you, Troy. And we're really looking forward to hearing how General Motors is forging its path to the future and finding success in the marketplace. Welcome.
Thanks, Chip. I appreciate those kind remarks, and I really appreciate the opportunity to meet with you all this afternoon, and really have the opportunity to share a couple things with you, but more importantly, to attempt to answer any questions that you might have about our industry, about General Motors in particular, or certainly receive any comments you have that could make me smarter. I really like going places and leaving a little smarter than when I came, and I usually find when I do things like this that is indeed the case. You know, Atlanta is an important market for General Motors. I'm spending the whole day here doing various things. I had the opportunity to talk to the chamber this morning. I got the opportunity to go to Georgia Tech this afternoon. And then I'm going to do something that I have been doing all around the country, and that is participate in some focus group activities. This is kind of the behind-the-mirror kind of focus group activities. There's some potential car buyers. Usually we attempt to capture some segment of the market and, you know, bring them in and actually facilitate some level of questioning around what they think is important in buying a car, what are they looking for, and then ultimately we kind of lead up to some of their comments on General Motors, our products, and our brands. I've done this in several coastal communities, in particular in California, in the south, in Florida, and I'm kind of working my way up the Atlantic coast, and so now here I am in Atlanta. Somebody asked me this morning, well, why are you doing this in Atlanta? Well, Atlanta is one of a handful of coastal communities which happen to be the places where the trends are set in America. And in fact, if you look at General Motors or the market share of our brands, you'll find that our market share is rock solid in the center of the country. I mean, you know, I think we are by far the biggest car company in South Dakota, and we're very proud of that fact. And but you know, we aren't the biggest car company in some of the areas we call the Smile States, the states where in fact foreign name branded products, you know, first came to the United States, and in the course of doing that, you know, established, you know, very good customer bases. And it's kind of like, gee, these are still the best markets. They're the markets that set the trends. They're the markets where really we need to have probably a higher level of recognition and influence than we do today. And what better way to start that than just by coming to those markets and spending more time there and spending more time listening to people and not just, you know, not making them listen to me, because that's kind of an inside-out view of the world, but in fact me listening to them so that I can make sure that whatever it takes to be able to succeed and satisfy customers in these markets is the kind of thing that I can contribute in the decision-making process of General Motors. I'll tell you, that's kind of tough to do at times. You know, our presence in California is not, you know, where we would want it to be. And in fact, you know, people have some pretty harsh things to say about some of our brands and some of their recollections of our brands. You know, but on the other hand, I'll tell you, there's a whole generation of people there all across the United States that are growing up. And I got to tell you, this is the kind of the smartest generation of people that this nation has ever had. And people who really are very thoughtful about their view on almost everything, and certainly to include the auto industry and the type of products that they drive. And so I try to spend as much time as I can away from Detroit. Yeah, I have a kind of a myopic view in Detroit. Heck, I think the U.S. auto industry is in great shape when I'm driving around on the streets of Detroit, but that's just because they're all domestic products. I get a much different view when I come visit communities like Atlanta, and I think that view is very important for us to be able to internalize. So getting closer to customers is something that's real important. I think as we look at the future of the auto industry, it starts and it ends with the customer. I think that we're an industry right now at a significant crossroads. I don't think that crossroads is the crossroads of domestic versus foreign nameplated manufacturers anymore. That might have been the crossroads that existed in the 1990s and even maybe part of the late 80s. I think that the crossroads we're at today is we are pretty much a global industry. We have the ability, I think, to bring global resources to bear on problems and issues that I think impact most of our that impact people who are important to us, like customers. But I think the crossroads we're at today is very interesting, and it is a global crossroads in many regards, because I think it's on subjects like energy security. It's like, where is the source of the energy that's going to propel your products down the road? And if, in fact, that source is an imported source, then that source is subject to risk. That source is subject to causes of inflation, which may have nothing to do with the economic attributes of your home market. A lot of the cost of or the price of oil recently is really driven by the weakening of the U.S. dollar, which is caused by a number of factors. But if you're an oil producer, you're attempting to preserve the purchase power of that barrel of oil, basically, by balancing off a basket of currencies, of which the U.S. dollar just happens to be one. And so your economic model will say, I need to raise the price in terms of U.S. dollars, which is the commodity with which oil is traded, so that I get a similar purchasing power for a dollar that is worth less in global currency markets. Foreign exchange is a hard thing to explain to people as to why the price of your gas is going to go up, but it's a very real factor in a global economy, in a global world. I think a second thing that's very interesting is, in fact, the concern over climate change. You know, there is no doubt. You know, scientists have indicated we are experiencing climate change. And there's a lot of theories as to what causes it. But, you know, I think it's the kind of thing that we don't want to be wrong, and we all want to do the right kind of thing in order to address some of this. So I think climate change is an important issue. And obviously, the role that the automobile plays in that whole equation is a very important one for us to take a leadership position on. And then last but not least is just the cost of ownership of your vehicle, or what it costs you to get from point A to point B. And that has a lot to do with whether you're paying $3 a gallon for gas or $5 a gallon for gas. So you take all three of those and you put them together and you say, this is the crossroads that not just the industry here in the U.S. is, but I had been in Asia, actually living in China before I returned in 2006. It's the exact circumstance that they face in China as well. So it's a rather common set of issues that the industry as a whole faces, and I think that there is a broad diversity of ways that we can get at some of that. In some countries, for various reasons, like Europe, diesel engine applications is a very expedient way to get at some of the issues around carbon dioxide emissions. One of the reasons why is because they already had a lot of diesel engine penetration and were very well accepted by the products, by the consumers over there. So that seemed like a good starting point for them. But there isn't a lot of passenger car diesel engine application in the U.S., so it's a slightly different starting point, you know, for us. But I use that as an example to say that countries aren't starting at the same spot, but I think they're all moving to the same place. Energy independence, less environmental impact, especially as it relates to global warming, and lowering the cost or managing the cost of transportation. In General Motors, and in particular in Chevrolet, you may have seen this in some of our advertising, we call this gas-friendly to gas-free. At this particular point in time, which is very reminiscent in my mind to the early part of the century, when it wasn't a foregone conclusion that internal combustion engines would win out on the technology to propel vehicles. As a matter of fact, there was a point in the earlier part of the century when there were more electric vehicles on the road than there were internal combustion engine vehicles. But the internal combustion engine ultimately won out, and it won out because it had superior performance characteristics. It made it up very well with an emerging infrastructure of a domestic oil industry that was being developed at the time. And it could deliver vehicles at a cost point that a lot of people could have ultimately, you know, afford. So it wasn't just, you know, how good of a job did you do as a manufacturer of an incessant early electric vehicle. You could have made one of great quality, but the fact of the matter is that the infrastructure and the economic support for that type of vehicle in the market really just wasn't there at that particular point in time. And now I think where we're at in the auto industry today is we need to go back and re-examine all of those technologies, and that's what we talk about when we say gas-friendly to gas-free. Certainly, there's more efficiency to be gained from improving internal combustion engines with very sophisticated transmissions on top of those. There's certainly an opportunity for diesel engines and a role that they can play. There's a role for hybrids. And in fact, there's probably a role for several different types of hybrids. We can have several varieties of those that would appear. There's a role for something that we call the extended range electric vehicle, which is in fact an electric vehicle that has an onboard gas generator kind of thing that keeps your battery charged. And then last but not least, fuel cell electric vehicles or ultimately just electric vehicles by themselves. And at this point in time, we think the right bet to make is not on any one of those, but is in fact on all of those. And this is where a global company like General Motors can actually saddle up the technology that we have around the world and bring it to bear to a market like the United States. And then I think, you know, my last point that I'll make, it's very important that the customer help choose which technology, which solution ultimately wins. Because if we've learned anything, it's we can't sell you what we want. We have to sell you what you want. And so we think our strategy right now is to offer you these type of choices and then allow you to vote with your wallets, with your pocketbooks, and then ultimately which technology suits your needs is in fact the technology that wins out. And I think we're going to be in this kind of mix for a while because these technologies don't mature in their first cycle. They'll typically mature through 3 or 4 learning cycles. So we may be in for a 20-year period of time where the choice available to you for sources of propulsion have never been greater. And your vote is very important. And so I'm really kind of out here not campaigning to sell one or more of these, but in fact, you know, kind of listening to the voters so that we can try to anticipate your needs and I think do a better job in even bringing more technology to bear on these three common issues. And so with that, you know, let me stop there. And I think that I really didn't bring any other prepared comments. I have a whole bunch of slides that could potentially support the type of questions that we would anticipate you might ask, but I don't know that until I actually get a couple of questions. Yes?
As far as showing the gas-friendly to gas-free, and you've explained why you're putting your bets on all the different brands, is it General Motors' plan to bring that technology to all the different brands, for example, including Hummer?
Yes, absolutely. As a matter of fact, we put this campaign together and chose to create these the symbolism around it. As you see, the symbolism itself will be adopted across General Motors brands. Now, every brand may not have every one of those technologies applied. So, for instance, a brand like Hummer may have diesel engines and biofuel engines. A brand like Hummer may not have hybrids. We haven't made that decision right yet. But it doesn't mean that all technologies apply to all brands. Chevrolet is our biggest brand. It's our biggest distribution footprint. And it's the brand that we have the most products within. So it really makes sense that Chevrolet play very broadly across all of those.
All right. One of our folks wants to know, the typical car buyer might consider a hybrid vehicle if they were more affordable. Mm-hmm. Do you foresee the price of the hybrids coming more in line with traditional gas vehicles?
Yeah, I don't think that they'll ever come completely in line with the price of gas vehicles. If you think about this for a minute, you have two powertrains on the vehicle, two very sophisticated powertrains. You have a gasoline engine and transmission, and the concept of being a parallel hybrid that is always, always participating in the drive of the vehicle in some way, shape, or form. And then you have basically an electric car that is there as well. So, and with a complete electric drivetrain. So, for instance, in our two-mode hybrid, which is shown up here, there's two electric motors which are actually integrated into the transmission. When you start from a stoplight, the engine shuts off at a stoplight. You will actually drive on pure electric power up to 25 miles per hour. And what limits you there is depleting your battery, okay, through that particular period of time. And then the engine will kick on. So you have this need for two total powertrains. I don't think that we know yet how to reduce the cost so that it costs as much as or as little as a conventional internal combustion engine at this point in time. You think about the internal combustion engine, it has benefited from 100 years of evolution into a very sophisticated, very cost-effective product. And so what we're really doing is we're adding cost to it. Now, that said, what I didn't say was is that it doesn't make sense. And I think that in most cases, if you could pay it back through additional or through lower fuel costs or lower cost of ownership, then, in fact, you might not mind paying a little bit more for a hybrid. I do think the costs will come down or the prices will come down over time as the technology matures. I don't think it'll ever match up, but I do suspect that it comes into a range where it makes a good business case, you know, in your purchase decision.
Steve Matthews from Bloomberg News asks, are we in a recession? And if so, when did it begin? And what do you think that the Fed or Congress should do to address the economy?
Well, if I knew we were in a recession, I'd probably be on CNN right now or MSNBC. I think, and I read this just like the rest of you do, it's really not practical. You can't tell that you're in a recession until you look backwards for two quarters of negative economic growth, right? And so that's why nobody says at this point in time that we're in a recession, is because we haven't seen two quarters of negative economic growth. I will tell you this, the first quarter of this year feels kind of tough in the auto business. So, you know, I think it feels like there's a recession. I can't tell you that technically it's really there. It's really there or not. I think the things that we have to be concerned about, first off, I think that we have experienced about six quarters of contraction in the auto market in the U.S. We believe that the trend rate for this auto market should be in the neighborhood of 17 million units, a sales rate that would support 17 million units of light vehicles per year. The last 2 years did not kind of get to those levels. January and February sold at a rate of about, that would point to a seasonal adjusted selling rate of about 15.6 million units. A lot of people said it would be worse. I tend to be an optimist. I think that there is some resiliency to the market, and this is about the bottom. 15.6 million units is still a pretty good market. It's the largest auto market in the world. And I think that as people work through their adjustable rate mortgages and the stimulus package that comes out, I think in early May, the checks will be mailed as part of tax refunds. And I think what ends up happening is that people, consumers, can get their own balance sheets in order. And then after they get their balance sheets in order, I think that they'll be back into the car market. And so I personally believe that later this year, whether it's the third quarter or the fourth quarter, we begin to see the market exhibiting signs of growth. And then we'll see how fast it grows and we see how far it grows. But I think after six quarters of contraction, and maybe this will be the seventh, I think that there is some signs of demand that is not being satisfied. And the only thing is keeping people from doing it, I think, is to get in their own balance sheets in order. And when they do that, I think that they'll be back into the market.
Does the government have any more right to tell the auto industry what mile per gallon standards there should be than it does a restaurant industry what goods it can serve? Doesn't the market take care of all of this?
Certainly, market forces, play a very important role. Truthfully, I came into the industry in 1973. I think it was 1978 the first CAFE laws were passed. So I don't have a lot of experience in an industry that hasn't had some form of regulation with regards to fuel economy. So hard for me to visualize if the market would completely have, would the market have brought us to where we're at today? Yeah, I don't know. I think that there is a role for appropriate public policy. I think the concept of improved fuel economy is a good thing, and that in fact it's all about finding the right balance. It's all about finding the sweet spot. Fortunately, the energy legislation in the 1970s was written, you know, maximum technically feasible, maximum economically feasible. So in fact, when they make rules, even back in the 1970s, they brought in the automakers and said, okay, what's your technology allow you to do? And in fact, what impact does this have on the economy? So, if we increase the price of cars too fast, that slows down demand. If you slow down demand, that forces layoffs or resizing of your industry or creates a different competitive balance. They try to factor all those things in. I don't know that they could do that more effectively than they do, but at least it's considered, I think, as they kind of pull that stuff forward. We don't have the rules yet for the new CAFE legislation that was passed as part of the energy bill last year, but you know, those same kind of words are in there. You know, maximum technically feasible, and then certainly some level of understanding of the economic impact of the United States of this type of regulation. So, you know, I have confidence that the requirements of the industry will land in a zone that will be very difficult to achieve, but will be achievable. And my thought is, and my hope is that we're able to do that in such a fashion that still allows people to purchase the kind of vehicles that they want to purchase to satisfy their needs. You know, that's our goal. And again, if I was a betting man, you know, I'd bet on the concept of invention and, you know, entrepreneurial spirit that exists in our business and our industry, that we'll be able to figure out those puzzles and we'll be able to continue to survive and succeed in this market.
A lot of people want to know about the electric vehicles and the fuel cell vehicles. Carla Sinclair from Atlanta Daybook asks, how much longer will the test of the fuel cell cars take, and what have the early results of the test shown?
Well, what we've done is we're in the process. I think we've distributed about 89 of 100 fuel cell Equinoxes. This is the largest distribution of a fleet of fuel cell vehicles in history. This is not our exact latest generation, but the second to the last generation of fuel cells. This fuel cell represents a very productionable product. This is a product that we think at scale could be manufactured for about the same price that an internal combustion engine is. We think that it would have 50,000 hours of durability, which is about the same kind of durability that an internal combustion engine has. So we think this is a very marketable entity. The real challenge that remains is onboarding enough hydrogen so that you can have 300 to 400 miles of range. This vehicle has between, I think, 250 and 300 miles of range. So we'd like to put more hydrogen storage on it. And I think that's one of the challenges we face, because that's why we put it in a sport utility vehicle, because it gives us the opportunity to put larger tank sizes on it. But there's a lot of research taking place right now on how best to store hydrogen on a vehicle. And I think as that technology moves forward, it'll kind of get there by the time the infrastructure of hydrogen, you know, develops. One of the things we've learned, people love the vehicle. It's incredibly quiet. You know, the loudest noises that you hear is the blower of your heating and air conditioning system. Electric vehicles, a fuel cell vehicle is really an electric vehicle. The fuel cell just makes the electricity. Electric vehicles have some very interesting driving characteristics. An electric motor has its highest torque at near zero RPM. So the launch of an electric vehicle, and some of you can recognize this from a fully charged golf cart, the launch of the vehicle is very, you know, it puts you back in your seat. I mean, it's got this great feel. And it's not, you don't put your foot on the gas and say, okay, when's something going to happen? You know, no, you put your foot on the gas and boom, you know, you push back in the seat and it launches, and it launches very well. So we're getting nothing but good feedback from the customers on it. So far, the vehicle's lived up to our durability expectations, and we expect that we're going to learn a lot on that. Interestingly enough, a company like General Motors, we have this OnStar product. Anybody in here heard of OnStar? You know, one of the great things about OnStar is it lets us be in communications with these vehicles. We are downloading the vehicle diagnostics almost real time, so that if something goes wrong with the vehicle that the customer can't even detect, we call the customer and say, hey, where are you at? We're going to send somebody out to take a look at the vehicle because we got an error code set, because we're in communication via satellite communication with these vehicles, so that we can make sure that they're that we're learning as much as we can from those. It's a kind of a GM exclusive, this OnCar product, OnStar product, and it has a lot of very good applications. So we're very anxious to get the balance of the fuel cell vehicles in the fleets. They're real customers who are driving them to work every day. They're primarily located in Washington, D.C., the northeast corridor between Boston and New York area, and then L.A. And we think those are three great test markets. They give us a great climatology, because there's winters, as cold winters and hot summers. They give us a great variety of traffic conditions. And those happen to be three communities who have expressed a desire to invest in a hydrogen distribution infrastructure. So, there are hydrogen fuel stations that are currently in place and some of them that are on the books for going forward. So we're very encouraged, and I think in the case of fuel cell vehicles, it isn't if they come to market, it's really when they come to market. And we'll gain a lot of knowledge on this.
We have time just for two more questions. Here's something that we want to know. Where does General Motors stand on addressing the size of the dealer body, specifically relative to competitors like Toyota?
Yeah, well, we have a very large dealer body in the United States. Maybe some of you are aware of this. I think well over 7,000 dealers. It's kind of a phenomenon of World War II, to be very honest. There was a tremendous shortage of vehicles right after World War II. So all of the company's money really had to go into basically investing in new models because the war production had stopped building vehicles for some period of time. So the auto industry didn't have a lot of money to invest in dealerships, and so we have this franchise model. And basically, we were looking for as many dealers as we could get in as many places as we could get. There were only a handful of competitors. They were all domestic competitors. And the race for market share at that point in time was kind of like McDonald's, right? I mean, it's try to get as many corners as you can and start selling cars in what was then a fairly closed market with no international competition. As such, if you look at the eastern part of the United States, we have, especially the Northeast, we have a ton of dealerships. They're very close together to each other. And by and large, they sell fewer units per year than west of the Mississippi, where a lot of those communities grew up after the war. In the 60s, basically, we had a different theory on how we were going to do some of that. So if you take a look at the western United States and the eastern United States, you got this difference. We are definitely over-dealered in many regards in some community, and we're working at that. I think, however, what's different with regards to General Motors than others is we're working at that in a very organic fashion. We have a sense as to how many dealers we'd like to have and where we'd like them to be. The fact of the matter is we don't own the dealerships and we don't run those businesses. Other entrepreneurs do that, and they do a great job at it. So we view our role as a facilitating role. We have certainly made our interests known. We believe that higher throughput is better for the business of a dealership, and well-located dealerships that are kind of new and modern and can invest in the right kind of talent, those are better for the dealer themselves and the customers. So I think we all share that vision, and I think there is some number of consolidations, moves, changes that take place every year, and they take place at a pretty constant pace, and we just really want to be there to help facilitate those. Slowly but surely, I would say, we're moving in the right direction. We expressed a handful of years ago that we'd like to have Buick, Pontiac, and GMC dealers come together. Today, there's only, I would tell you that 70 to 80% of all Buick, Pontiac, and GMCs are sold through combined Buick, Pontiac, GMC stores. The rest are sold through either a standalone Buick, Pontiac, or GMC store. And in each of those cases, there's only dozens of standalone dealers around those brands. And all of this is taking place in a rather short order of time, I think faster than a lot of us thought could take place. So I think we got the right plan. I really don't feel the need to make a lot of public statements on, what we want to do. The dealers understand. I think where it's in their interest and our interest, I think things kind of happen. So, and I think so far things are happening the right way.
Troy, the economy is obviously on everybody's minds, jobs, the future outlook. Locally here in Atlanta, some of the press wants to know, what are the plans for the General Motors plant in Doraville?
We're going to close the Doraville plant at the end of September. We had extended its production. Because although a small market for this product, the minivan market in Canada is still a pretty big, it's a big chunk of their market, small when it comes to relative size in the U.S. So we decided to change the model year of the vehicle to 2009. It really didn't require any investment. It's really just for registration purposes, and we'll build some number of units in the month of August and September that basically will be shipped north of the border and distributed through the Canadian dealership network. Minivans as a segment, you know, has been declining. It was a great segment when it was a terrific segment when there was one player. It was a great segment when there were two. It's not a very good segment when there's a half a dozen, especially as we've noticed that buyer preference has turned away from minivans and is moving to these products that we call crossovers. And in fact, on the screen there, you see, you know, the three entries that we've put in the market, which in many regards, you know, replaces and we think has done so very successfully, you know, the minivan, the traditional box, you know, minivan. Gives you, you know, the same kind of high seating position, gives you great fuel economy, gives you a different look, more of a sport utility look, but, you know, very much with the exception of the sliding door, it gives you great utility. In 2000 and, well, just a handful of years ago, we had about a 2% market share in this particular segment. Today, we sell over 500,000 of these. We never sold anywhere near that in minivans. We sold 500,000 of these. Very few of them cannibalize any of the other products in our market lineup. And we have about a 23 or 24% market share in the segment. So we're kind of proud of the fact that we kind of sensed one segment declining and another segment potentially emerging, and we were able to get in front of it what we think is a better product. And in fact, customers are voting with their wallets, as I indicated, to tell us that we made the right decision. Unfortunately, the Doraville plant has been dedicated to that minivan production for a long time. We really don't have another product to be able to put in it at this point in time, and so we've made the very difficult decision to cease our operations in the Doraville area. Hard to do. You know, I got to tell you, over my career, when I grew up in the manufacturing side of the business, and you know, I worked in sheet metal for a long time and supplied the Doraville plant. So been down here a lot, have a lot of friends that live in the community, but it's just part of business today. And I think we'll work through it, do the right things for the community, and certainly do the right things for the good men and women who have supported us for so long in that facility.
All right. Well, let's give Mr. Clark a nice round of applause. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Boy, thanks so much. It's great seeing you. I want to also thank the sponsors, Autotrader.com. Mr. Perry, thank you so much for bringing us this wonderful presentation. So many questions, so many wonderful questions. We appreciate the time. Mr. Clark is on a very tight schedule, obviously trying to get all the good information from our community in. So I'm grateful for everybody having the time and coming down today. Thank you.